Happy Sunday. Welcome back to Reading For Now on Monotonic Radio. We are back with week two of our Venezuela syllabus. Last week, we read two pieces, one specifically about the abduction of Maduro from Venezuela and kind of put into the historical context, and predominantly that the game book of saying that the head of a country is a narco terrorist and therefore must be, you know, extradited from their country and tried in the U.S. court was something that that Chavez was very, very pointedly worried about, and something that he explicitly said was something that they were going to try to do to him. And then the other piece that we read pertained particularly to just the precise lengthy history of the claiming of drugs and weaponry in other countries as an excuse to go in and invade and install new points of CIA-backed powers, and specifically how Marco Rubio has an extensive history himself in connection to drug cartels and his sort of specific role within the administration to upend South American governments in favor of putting right-wing CIA-backed leaders. And really how this is just, a lot of that was about, you know, the ripe history of anti-communist and anti-socialist efforts that lead American intervention across the world. And so that episode was called A Present History, and this episode is called A Past Analysis. And we have two readings from the 90s. One reading from 1991, it's called The Evidence of Experience by Joan W. Scott. And then we have excerpts from The Gulf War Did Not Take Place from 1995 by John Baudrillard. The focus of this week's readings is sort of looking at the type of war we now engage in the United States, of kind of being these not wars. You know, there's not a battleground. We're kind of simulating war. And he specifically is talking about the Gulf War. And then we have another piece called The Evidence of Experience, which I found on X, the Everything app, in relation to the sort of commentary right after Maduro's capture, that people in Venezuela are cheering for this. People in listen to the people of Venezuela who are telling you that they want this, and just how the historical notion of experience has been so has been in the perspective of this speech by, you know, experience as a historical practice. But her main critique, as we can see, is that simply saying that someone was there and felt something or feels some sort of way about something in no way contextualizes how that experience came to be and how might subjects come to feel certain ways about certain things. I'm excited to get into it. And with that being said, we're going to start with the Baudrillard, The Gulf War Did Not Take Place. We're going to be jumping around quite a bit, so some sections might not perfectly, you know, jump into each other, but hang with me. From the beginning, we knew that this war would never happen. After the hot war, the violence of conflict, after the Cold War, the balance of terror, here comes the dead war. The unfrozen Cold War, which leads us to grapple with the corpse of war and the necessity of dealing with the decomposing corpse from which nobody in the Gulf has managed to revive. America, Saddam Hussein, and the Gulf powers are fighting over the corpse of war. War has entered in definitive crisis. It is too late for the hot World War III. This has already taken place. Distilled down the years into the Cold War, there will be no other. It might have been supposed that the defection of the Eastern Bloc would have opened up new spaces of freedom for war by unlocking deterrence. Nothing of the sort. Since freedom for war, nothing of the sort, since deterrence had not come to an end. On the contrary, in the past, it had functioned as a reciprocal deterrence between the two blocks on the basis of a virtual excess of the means of destruction. Today it functions all the more effectively as self-deterrence. Total self-deterrence up and to including the self-dissolution of the Eastern Bloc, the profound self-deterrence of the American power and the Western power in general, paralyzed by its own strength and incapable of assuming it in the form of relations of force. This is why the Gulf War will not take place. It is neither reassuring nor comforting that it has become bogged into an interminable suspense. In this sense, the gravity of the non-event in the Gulf is even greater than the event of war. It corresponds to the highly toxic period which affects a rotting corpse and which can cause nausea and powerless stupor. Here again, our symbolic defenses are weak. The mastery of the end of war escapes us, and we all live in a uniform, shameful indifference, just like the hostages. Non-war is characterized by that degenerate form of war, which includes hostage manipulation and negotiation. Hostages and blackmail are the purest products of deterrence. The hostage has taken the place of the warrior. He has become the principal actor, the simulacral protagonist, or rather, in his pure inaction, the protagonizer of a non-war. The warriors bury themselves in the desert, leaving only hostages to occupy the stage. The hostage is the phantom actor, the extra who occupies the powerless stage of war. Today is the hostage at the strategic site, tomorrow the hostage at the Christmas present, as exchange value and liquidity. Fantastic degradation of that which was the very figure of the impossible exchange. With Saddam Hussein, even that strong value has weakened and become a symbol of the weak war. Saddam has made himself the capitalist of hostage value. After the market enslaves and proletarians, the vulgar merchant of the hostage market. Taking the place of the warrior's challenge, hostage value has become synonymous with the debility of war. We are all hostages of media intoxication, induced to believe in the war just as we were once led to believe in the revolution in Romania, and confined to the simulacrum of war as though confined to quarters. We are already all strategic hostages in situ. Our site is the screen on which we are virtually bombarded day by day, even while serving as exchange value. In this sense, the grotesque vaudeville played by Saddam Hussein is a diversion, at once a diversion of both war and international terrorism. His soft terrorism will at least have put the end to the hard terrorism of Palestinians and others, thereby showing him to be, in this, as in many other respects, the perfect accomplice of the West. The impossibility of proceeding to the act, this absence of strategy, implies the triumph of blackmail as strategy. In the case of Iran, there was still a challenge. With Saddam Hare, there is only blackmail. Saddam Hussein's objection lies in having vulgarized everything. Religious challenge has become fake holy war, the sacrificial hostages of commercial hostage, the violent refusal of the West, a nationalistic scam, and war on impossible comedy. But we have helped him do this. By allowing him to believe that he had won the war against Iran, we drove him towards the mirage of a victory against the West. This mercenary's revolt is indeed the only ironic and pleasing trait of the whole story. We are neither in a logic of war nor a logic of peace, but in a logic of deterrence, which has wound its way inexorably through 40 years of Cold War to a denouement in our current events, a logic of weak events to which belong those in Eastern Europe as well as the Gulf War. Peripeteias of an anorexic history. I think I wrote down the definition of that word somewhere. Maybe I thought to do that. Peripeteias, yeah. Of an anorexic history or an anorexic war, which can no longer devour the enemy because it is incapable. Oh, I actually did. A sudden reversal of fortune or circumstances, particularly in relation to a fictional narrative. This aligns with the fact that Baudrillard at this point is kind of talking at how war has become sort of a narrative of war because there's not really war and there's also no longer peace, but this constant, attempt to deter both peace and war, which is really interesting because if we remember from last week, something that Marco Rubio had explicitly said as to why, the past policy in terms of, stopping drug embargoes from entering the United States is just to seize it upon arrival. Obviously, the policy now is to bomb the oceans while in the water. And he explicitly says this is a deterrent, that, you know, stopping people as they arrived was not deterring people from trying, and said we have to, you know, blow them up into smithereens without any sort of evidence as to what those boats might be carrying. God knows Saddam Hussein is worthy of neither challenge nor annihilation, and there and thus devours itself. It is the de-intensified state of war, that of the right to war under the green light of the UN and with the abundance of precautions and concessions. It is bellicose equivalent of safe sex. Make war like love with a condom. On the Richter scale, the Gulf War would not even reach a 2 or 3. The buildup is unreal, as though the fiction of an earthquake were created by manipulating the measuring instruments. It is neither the strong form nor the degree zero of war, but the weak or physical degree, P-H-T-H-I-S-I-C-A-L, the asymptomatic form which allows a brush with war but no encounter, the transparent degree which allows war to be seen from the depths of the dark room. We should have been suspicious about the disappearance of the declaration of war, the disappearance with the symbolic passage to the act, which already presaged the disappearance of the end of hostilities, then of the distinction between winners and losers. The winner readily becomes the hostage of the loser, the Stockholm Syndrome, then of operations themselves. Since it never began, this war is therefore interminable. The dint of dreaming of pure war, of an orbital war, purged of all local and political peripetious, we have fallen into soft war, into the virtual impossibility of war, which translate in the paltry fantasia, where adversaries compete in de-escalation. As though the eruption of the event of war has become obscene and insupportable, no longer sustainable. Like every real event, moreover, everything is therefore transposed into the virtual, and we are confronted with a virtual apocalypse, a hegemony ultimately more dangerous than real apocalypse. This, I think I really, in reading the whole thing, this is my favorite paragraph. I think it really, the idea that war has become this insupportable, unsustainable project, and therefore we don't ever declare war, we just do war actions. It really makes me think of the Donald Trump is obsessed with the idea that he is like the peace president, and he's obsessed with this idea that he's, you know, he's fixed however many global conflicts and then is therefore owed the Nobel Peace Prize. And it's this interesting thing where it's like there's this sort of awareness on the right, at least from some parties, that war is this, like, you know, completely unsupportable, unsustainable thing that no one wants, especially their base. And then you have all of these, you know, committing, you know, actions of war while not declaring it. And the Democrats are very mad that they have not gone through the proper congressional process of declaring war against Venezuela, which sometimes makes you wonder whether or not they would be fine with it if there was a congressional approval of a war in Venezuela. So the most widespread belief in is in a logical progression from virtual to actual, according to which no available weapon will not one day be used, and such a concentration of force cannot but lead to conflict. However, this Aristotelian logic, which is no longer our own. Our virtual has definitively overtaken the actual, and we must be content with this extreme virtuality, which, unlike the Aristotelian, deters any passage to action. We are no longer in a logic of a passage from virtual to actual, but a hyper-realist logic of the deterrence of the real by the virtual. In this process, the hostages are once again revealing, extracted like molecules in an experimental process, then distilled by one by one in the exchange. It is their virtual death that is the issue, not their real death. Moreover, they die. At best, they disappear. They will never be a monument to the unknown hostage. Everyone is too ashamed of him. The collective shame which attaches to the hostage reflects the absolute degradation of the real hostility, war, into virtual hospitality. Saddam Hussein's guess. The passage to action suffers widespread infamy. It supposedly corresponds to the brutal lifting of repression, thus to a psychotic process. It seems that this obsession with the passage to action today governs all our behavior. Obsession with every real, event, with every real violence, with every real pleasure, which is too real. Against this obsession with the real, we have created a gigantic apparatus of simulation which allows us to pass into the act in vitro. This is true even of procreation. We prefer the exile of the virtual, which is television in the universal mirror, to the catastrophe of the real. War has not escaped this virtualization, which is like a surgical operation, the aim of which is so present to a facelifted war, the cosmetically treated specter of its death, an even more deceptive televisual subterfuge, as we saw at Tima Suara. Even the military has lost the privilege of use value, the privilege of real war. Deterrence has passed by that way, and it spares no one. No one than the politicians, the military personnel, do not know what to make of their real function, their function of death and destruction. They are pledged to the decoy of war as the others are to the decoy of power. P.S. To demonstrate the impossibility of war just at the moment when it must take place, when the signs of its occurrence are accumulating, is a stupid gamble, but it would have been even more stupid not to seize the opportunity. We may as well, on the available evidence, absence of image, and profusion of commentary, we could suppose an immense promotional exercise like that which once advertised a name brand, whose product never became known. Pure promotion, which enjoyed an immense success because it belonged to a pure speculation. The war is also pure and speculative, to the extent that we do not see the real event that it could be or that it would signify. It reminds us of that recent suspense advertisement. Today I take off the top, tomorrow I take off the bottoms. Today I unleash a virtual war, tomorrow I unleash a real war. In the background, a third advertisement in which a voracious and lubricous banker says, "Your money appeals to me." This sadly celebrated advertisement is reincarnated by Saddam Hussein saying to the West, "Your power appeals to me," as they rush to palm off a good share of it to him. Then to the Arabs, which with the same hypocrisy, "Your religious war appeals to me," as they rush to put all their money on him. In this manner, the war makes its way by promotion and speculation, including the use of hostages transformed into marketing ploys, and in the absence of any clarification of plans, balance sheets, losses, or operations. No enterprise would survive such uncertainty except for the precisely speculative risk management, otherwise known as the strategy of turning a profit from the worst, in other words, war, he's in parentheses, has equals a highly profitable, senseless project. War itself has taken this speculative turn. It is highly profitable, but uncertain. It can collapse from one day to the next. Obviously, this is now kind of shaded. Yeah, this is shaded by quite literally having a speculative market where you can bet actual money on war or actions of war or the virtual war or simulations of war. Risky but profitable. Nevertheless, from this point onwards, the promotional advantages are fabulous. Defeated or not, Saddam is assured of an unforgettable and charismatic label, victorious or not. American armaments will have acquired an unequaled technological label, and the sumptuary expenditure in material is already equivalent to that of real war, even if it has not taken place. We have still not left the virtual war. In other words, a sophisticated, although laughable, buildup against the backdrop of a global indeterminacy of will to make war, even in Saddam's case. Hence the absence of images, which is neither accidental nor due to censorship, but the impossibility of illustrating the indeterminacy of war. Promotional, speculative, virtual. This war no longer corresponds to Clausewitz's formula of politics pursued by other means. It rather amounts to the absence of politics pursued by other means. Non-war is a terrible test of the status and the uncertainty of politics, just as a stock market crash, the speculative universe, is a crucial test of the economy and the uncertainty of economic aims, just as any event, whatever, is terrible test of the uncertainty and the aims of information. Thus, real-time information loses itself in a completely unreal space, finally furnishing the images of pure, useless, instantaneous television, where its primordial function erupts, namely that of filling a vacuum, blocking up the screen hole through which escapes the substance of events. This sentence, non-war is a terrible test of the status and the uncertainty of politics, is like the reason why we are engaging in any sort of military action in South America is like that is kind of the final card usually of a failing politic is to do this sort of non-war. And of course, now we have one overseas and we have a sort of one at home. We have this sort of non-war, this sort of cold civil war occurring between, you know, a militarized border control in American cities, mainly not doing immigration work as much as they are doing the political protest work. And then this idea of like real information loses itself to a completely unreal space. We're losing information to non-real images. I remember the day that Maduro was captured, there was, I don't know, maybe 20 pictures of him circulating, of him wearing all entirely different outfits. And there was this like big kind of question of like, how many outfits has this guy changed? And it's like, there were so many widely circulated fake AI images of perp walking of Maduro. And not to mention, you know, that's kind of the war overseas. The war at home, the government themselves has been altering the faces of protesters they've been arresting to make them look like they're crying. It's a very bizarre thing. Nor is the promotion of the pursuit of the economy by other means. On the contrary, it is the pure product of uncertainty with regards to the rational aims of production. This is why it has become a relentless function, the emptiness of which fills our screens to the extent of the absence of economic finality or rationality. This is why it competes victoriously with the war on our screens, both alternating in the same virtual credit of the image. The media promote the war. The war promotes the media. The advertising competes with the war. Promotion is the most thick-skinned parasite in our culture. It would undoubtedly survive a nuclear conflict. It is our last judgment. But it is also like a biological function. It devours our substance, but it also allows us to metabolize what we absorb. Like a parasitic plant or intestinal flora, it allows us to turn the world and the violence of the world into a consumable substance. So war or promotion. The war, along with the fake, presumptive warriors, generals, experts, and television presenters we see speculating about it all throughout the day, watches itself in a mirror. Am I pretty enough? Am I operational enough? Am I spectacular enough? Am I sophisticated enough to make an entry onto the historical stage? Of course, this anxious interrogation increases the uncertainty with respect to its possible eruption. It is uncertainty. And this uncertainty invades our screens like a real oil slick in the image of that blind seabird stranded on the beach in the Gulf, which will remain the symbol image of what we all are in front of our screens, in front of that sticky and unintelligible event. Unlike earlier wars, in which there were political aims either of conquest or domination, what is at stake in this one is war itself, its status, its meaning, its future. It is beholden not to have an objective, but to prove its very existence. The crisis of identity affects the existence of its all. I mean, crisis of identity, talk about, you know, the Department of War. Like, peace through strength. Like, that's, it's a kind of an identity crisis of like, do we want to be the arbiter of peace or do we want to be warmongers? In effect, it has lost much of its credibility. Who, apart from the Arab masses, is still capable of believing in it and becoming inflamed by it? Nevertheless, the spectacular drive of war remains intact. In the absence of the greatly diminished will to power and the problematic will to knowledge, there remains today the widespread will to spectacle, and with that, the obstinate desire to preserve its specter or fiction. This is the fate of religions. They are no longer believed, but the disincarnate practice remains. Can war still be saved? Empty war. It brings to mind those games in the World Cup football, which has been decided by penalties because of the impossibility of forcing a decision. As though the players punish themselves by means of penalties for not having been able to play and take the match in full battle, we might as well have begun with the penalties and dispensed with the game and its sterile standoff. So with the war, it could have begun at the end and spared us the forced spectacle of the unreal war, where nothing is extreme, in which, whatever the outcome, will leave behind the smell of undigested programming and the entire world irritated as though after an unsuccessful copulation. It is a war of excesses, of means, of material, of war, of shedding or purging stocks, of experimental deployment, of liquidation and fire sale, along with the display of future ranges of weaponry. A war between excessive, superabundant, and over-equipped societies, Iraq included, committed both to waste, including human waste, and the necessity of getting rid of it. Just as the waste of time nourishes the hell of leisure, so technical wastes nourish the hell of war. Wastes which incarnate the secret violence of this society, uncoerced and non-degradable defecation. The renowned American stocks of World War II surplus, which appeared to us luxury, have become a suffocating global burden. The war functions well within its possibilities in this role of purgative and expenditure. If the critical intellectual is in the process of disappearing, it seems by contrast that his phobia of the real and of action has been distilled throughout the sinuous and cerebral network of our institutions. In this sense, the entire world, including the military, is caught up in the process of intellectualization. See them become fused in explanations, outdo themselves in justifications, and lose themselves in the technical details. War drifts slowly into technological mannerism, or to the deontology of a pure electronic war without hitches. These are the aesthetes speaking, postponing settlement dates into the interterminal and decisions into the undecidable. Their war processors, their radars, their lasers, their screen renders the passage to war as futile and impossible as the use of a word processor renders futile and impossible the passage to the act of writing, because it removes from it in advance any dramatic uncertainty. The generals also exhaust their artificial intelligence in correcting their scenarios, polishing their war scripts so much that they sometimes make errors of manipulation and lose the plot. The famous philosophical epoch has become universal on the screens as much as on the field of battle. Should we applaud the fact that all of these techniques of war processing culminate in the elision of the duration and the violence of war? Only eventually, for the indefinite delay of the war is itself heavy with deadly consequences in all domains. Yeah. There's one more. I'm going to read one more paragraph, actually. This is the problem with anticipation. Is there still a chance that something which will have been meticulously programmed will occur? Does a truth which has been meticulously demonstrated still have the chance of being true? When too many things point in the same direction, when the objective reasons pile up, the effect is reversed. Thus, everything which points to war is ambiguous, the buildup of force, the play of tension, the concentration of weapons, even the green light from the UN. Far from reinforcing the probability of conflict, these function as preventative accumulation, as substitution for and the diversion from the transition to war. This idea of like when too many things pile up in the direction of war, the effect is, like, the eagerness to go to war actually goes away. I mean, if we look at the United States, we have a NATO country, us, threatening to invade and conquer another NATO nation, Greenland. There's no sort of international conversation as to whether or not there should be some sort of war or, you know, collective effort to stop the U.S. from doing that. I mean, like, we're talking, like, one, a sovereign country threatening to invade and conquer another sovereign country that is contractually an ally. And yet, the reasons in the direction towards war or towards even deterrence has been completely reversed. Virtual for 5 months, the war will shortly enter its terminal phase, according to the rule which says that it never began, ends without having taken place. The profound indeterminacy of this war stems from the fact that it is both terminated in advance and indeterminable. The virtual succeeds itself, accidents aside, which could only be the eruption of the other in the field, but no one wants to hear the other talk. Ultimately, the undecidability of the war is grounded in the disappearance of alterity, of primitive hostility, and of the enemy. War has become a celibate machine. Yeah, I mean, that's been, for those listening in their 20s, I mean, that has been our entire lives, of, like, these wars with no winners, no losers, no start date, no end date. Just this permanent cycle of indeterminate action. You know, I think just a couple days ago, I got a news notification about, you know, us looking into sending troops into Iran. It's like, and here we go again. Nothing is ever done. The troops leave. They don't all leave, and the bases are still there. We're going to transition into our other piece now. So again, this is the evidence of experience. Joan W. Scott, who at the time was a professor for the Institute of Advanced Study at Princeton, which I don't even know if that exists anymore. The communication of knowledge has long been the mission of historians, documenting the lives of those omitted or overlooked in accounts of the past. It has produced a wealth of new evidence previously ignored about these others and has drawn attention to dimensions of human life and activity usually deemed unworthy of mention in conventional histories. It has also occasioned a crisis for Orthodox history by multiplying not only the stories, but subjects, and by insisting that histories are written from fundamentally different, indeed, I should know that word. Can you help me with that? Irreconcilable perspectives or standpoints, none of which are complete or completely true. Like Delaney's, a lot of this has been, this piece is really fantastic, but it's also an academic paper. It's very referential. So if there's a name that hasn't been explained, it's because I, you know, shortened it for time. Like Delaney's memoir, these histories have provided evidence for a world of alternative values and practices whose existence gives the lie to hegemonic constructions of social worlds. Whether these constructions vaunt the political superiority of white men, the coherence and the unity of selves, the naturalness of heterosexual monogamy, or the inevitability of scientific progress and economic development. The challenge to normative history has been described in terms of conventional historical understandings of evidence. As an enlargement of the picture, a correction to oversights resulting in inaccurate or incomplete vision, has rested its claim to legitimacy on the authority of experience, the direct experience of others, as well as the historian who learns to see and illuminate the lives of those others or in his or her texts. Documenting the experience of others in this way has been at once a highly successful and limiting strategy for historians of difference. It has been successful because it remains so comfortably with in the disciplinary framework of history, working according to rules that permit calling old narratives into questions when new evidence is discovered. The status of evidence is, of course, ambiguous for historians. On the one hand, they acknowledge that evidence only counts as evidence as it is recognized as such in relation to a potential narrative. So the narrative can be said to determine the evidence as much as the evidence determines the narrative. On the other hand, historians' rhetorical treatment of evidence and their use of it to falsify prevailing interpretations depends on a referential notion of evidence, which denies that it is anything but a reflection of the real. The reason I chose this piece was largely because of this idea that, you know, if we see a video on Twitter of people in Venezuela celebrating in the streets of Maduro's capture, that means it is not only justified that we did that, but it was good and it was what the people wanted. And like, who are we to say no to the people's demands? And obviously that's just a really, if you even sort of think about it, and if France were to come and abduct Trump from Mar-a-Lago, you would certainly have a lot of people in the streets being very happy about it. But on the other hand, there is the added context of, should someone still be able to do that? And obviously we're thinking about Venezuela, but we're also thinking and looking forward to next week is going to be much more about ICE and particularly just the Americans' view of the other, in this case, immigrants. And if anyone watched that awful interview with Andrew Callahan and Nick Shirley, who was the one that went into Minnesota and is now he's in California, apparently this morning, harassing daycare facilities that he believes are fraudulent. There is this phrasing here, the authority of experience, which, and I think a lot of this is a really intensely American belief, I think, that where someone demands they have an objective grasp of truth on a situation by means because you have been there and seen things. And this is an argument that Nick Shirley returns to multiple times in this interview, is that because he's been to Minnesota, because he talked to neighbors of a preschool, that he has an objective true look at like who Somali people are and who immigrants are. But again, evidence only counts as evidence as it is recognized in relation to a potential narrative. You know, you are looking for evidence, you're looking for experience that has been kind of gifted this level of authority that no historian is really really granted, or even, you know, more dedicated journalists are granted in today's culture. And but without recognizing that evidence always exists in context of the narrative that it's trying to build. So Michael de Coutel's description is apt. Historical discourse, he writes, gives itself credibility in the name of reality, which it's supposed to represent. But its authorized appearance of the real serves precisely to camouflage the practice in which in fact determines it. Representation thus disguises the practice that organizes it. When the evidence offered is the evidence of experience, the claim for referentiality is further buttressed. What could be truer, after all, than a subject's own account of what he or she has lived through? It is precisely this kind of appeal to experience as uncontestable evidence, as an originary point of explanation, as a foundation of which analysis is based, that weakens the critical thrust of histories of difference. By remaining with the epistemological frame of orthodox history, these studies lose the possibility of examining those assumptions and practices that excluded considerations of difference in the first place. They take as self-evident the identities of those whose experience is being documented and thus naturalize their difference. They locate resistance outside of the discursive construction and reify agency as an inherent attribute of individuals, thus decontextualizing it. When experience is taken as the origin of knowledge, the vision of the individual subject, the person who had the experience or the historian who recounts it, becomes the bedrock of evidence on which explanation is built. Questions about the constructed nature of experience, about how subjects are constituted as different in the first place, about how one's vision is structured, about language or discourse in history are left aside. The evidence of experience then becomes evidence for the fact of difference, rather than a way of exploring how difference is established, how it operates, and how and why it constitutes subjects to see and act in the world. So after every, you know, major event, you see this sort of race to establish the history or the chronology of events. And then we search for experiences that, you know, confirm our narrative. And in that process, you lose discourse and conversation about how contradictory experiences emerge. We've seen this so, and this is a lot of what I'm going to be talking about next week. We have seen this so much with the murders of Renee Good and Alex Preddy, where a video emerges and then the production of the same video from another angle, you know, like attempting to prove that something else had occurred, is this sort of arms race between images in order to then state these to two separate images as one is more real than the other, as one more accurately depicting the reality of events than the other one. But it doesn't begin to mention, you know, that that same discourse doesn't begin to mention why bystanders and law enforcement themselves are in this sort of phone battle between one another. And, you know, and then at one point someone will drop the phone and pick up a gun. And we lose so much. And it's like, you know, for every Twitter video that someone posts a Twitter video trying to state the opposite. And I think that's, you know, it's really dangerous. And this is what Scott is pointing out here. The project of making experience visible precludes analysis of the workings of a system and its historicity. Instead, it reproduces its terms. We come to appreciate the consequences of the closeting of a lot of this talks about how this sort of like history of experience plays into like the formations of social identities and social structures. So like you'll see like every so often we'll talk about like women and queer people. And so, yeah, that's what that's coming from. We come to appreciate the consequences of the closeting of homosexuals, and we understand repression as it is an interested act of power or domination. Alternative behaviors and institutions also become available to us. What we don't have is a way of placing those alternatives within the framework of historically contingent dominant patterns of sexuality and the ideology that supports them. We know they exist, but not how they have been constructed. We know their existence offers a critique of normative practice, but not the extent of the critique. Making visible the experience of a different group exposes the existence of repressive mechanisms, but not their inner workings or logics. We know that difference exists, but we don't understand it as relationally constituted, which is, this is a beautiful way of phrasing like why you can have two videos emerge from Venezuela of people feeling very different things about the capture of their president. And all that does, all that producing those two images does, makes visible that there are two separate images, but it in no way discursively puts them in relationship to one another or into the relationship of history. And the reason why this is paired with the Baudrillard is because of his insistence on so much of these American interventions, of these non-wars, is that of a promotion, of like the cultural, promotional media propaganda that surrounds and constructs and lifts up these wars with toothpicks. And thus people emerge with incredibly different views of what's happening. For that, we need to attend to the historical processes that through discourse position subjects and produces their experiences. It is not individuals who have experience, but subjects who are constituted through experience. Experience in this definition then becomes not the origin of our explanation, not the authoritative because seen or felt evidence that grounds what is known, but rather that which we seek to explain, that about which knowledge is produced. To think about experience in this way is to historicize it as well as to historicize the identities it produces. This kind of historicizing represents a reply to the many contemporary historians who have argued that an unproblematized experience is the foundation of their practice. It is historicizing and that implies critical scrutiny of all explanatory categories usually taken for granted, including the category of experience. I'm just looking ahead. Okay, cool. The authority of experience. History has been largely a foundationalist discourse. By this, I mean that its explanations seem to be unthinkable if they do not take for granted some primary premises, categories, or presumptions. These foundations, however varied, whatever they are at a particular moment, are unquestioned and unquestionable. They are considered permanent and transcendent. As such, they create a common ground for historians in their objects of study in the past, and so authorize and legitimize analysis. Indeed, analysis seems not to be able to proceed without them. In the minds of some foundationalists, in fact, nihilism, anarchy, and moral confusion are the sure alternatives of these givens, which have the status, if not the philosophical definition, of eternal truths. Historians have had recourse to many kinds of foundations, some more obviously empiricist than others. What is most striking these days is the determined embrace, the strident defense of some reified transcendent category of explanation by historians who have used insights drawn from sociology of knowledge, structural linguistics, feminist theory, or cultural anthropology develop sharp critiques of empiricism. This turn to foundations, even by anti-foundationalists, appear in Frederick Jameson's characterization as some extreme form of the return of the repressed. Experience is one of the foundations that has become reintroduced into historical writing in the wake of the critique of empiricism. Unlike brute fact or simple reality, its connotations are more varied and elusive. It has recently emerged as a critical term in debates among historians about the limits of interpretation, and especially about the uses and limits of post-structuralist theory for history. In these debates, those most open to interpretive innovation, those who have insisted on the study of collective mentalities, of economic, social, or cultural determinations of individual behavior, and even of the influences of unconscious motives of thought and action, are among the most ardent defenders of the need to attend to experience. Feminist historians, critical of biases in mainstream histories and seeking to install women as viable subjects, social historians insisting on the materialist basis of the discipline on the one hand and on the agency of individuals or groups on the other, and cultural historians who have brought in symbolic analysis to the study of behavior have joined political historians whose stories privilege the purposive actions of rational actors and intellectual historians who maintain that thought originates in the minds of individuals, all seem to have converged on the argument that experience is an irreducible ground for history. The evolution of experience appears to solve a problem of explanation for professed anti-empiricists as it reinstates foundational ground. For this reason, it is interesting to examine the uses of experience by historians, such as an examination allows us what asks us whether history can exist without foundations and what it might look like if it did. We can see this, like there's a sort of like term that has emerged in this sort of like therapization of how we kind of speak to one another about invalidating one's experience. Like, it's like, I went to this restaurant and I thought the waiter was rude. And someone then goes, well, I mean, how do you know that they were being rude? Maybe they're having a bad day. Oh, you're invalidating my experience. As if someone's experience, someone's interpretation of the events is, again, this, you know, foundational ground of truth that your experience of culture, of history, of economics, of politics is something that is now this like sacrosanct thing not to be tread upon or questioned. We're We're wrapping up on this. In Keywords, Raymond Williams sketches the alternative senses in which the term experience has been employed in the Anglo-American tradition. Then he summarizes, one, knowledge gathered from past events, whether to be conscious observation or consideration and reflection, and two, a particular kind of consciousness, which can in some complex be distinguished from reason or knowledge. Until the early 18th century, he says experience and experiment were closely connected terms, designating how knowledge was arrived at through testing and observation. Here, the visual metaphor is important. In the 18th century, experience still contained this notion of consideration or reflection on his own observed events. The lessons gained from the past, but is also referred to a particular kind of consciousness. The consciousness in this 20th century has become to mean a full act of awareness, including feeling as well as thought. The notion of experience as subjective witness, writes Williams, is offered not only as truth, but as the most authentic kind of truth, as the ground for all subsequent reasoning and analysis. According to Williams, experience has acquired another connotation in the 20th century different from these notions of subjective testimony as immediate, true, and authentic. In the usage, it refers to influences external to individuals, social conditions, institutions, forms of belief or perception, real things outside them that they react to, and does not include their thought or consideration. In the various usages described by Williams, experience, whether conceived as internal or external, subjective or objective, establishes the prior existence of individuals. When it is defined as internal, it is an expression of an individual's being or consciousness. When external, it is material on which the consciousness then acts. Talking about experience in these ways leads us to take the existence of individuals for granted. Experience is something people have, rather than to ask how conceptions of selves, of subjects, and their identities are produced. It operates within an ideological construction not only makes individuals the starting point of knowledge, but also naturalizes categories as man, woman, black, white, heterosexual, and homosexual by treating them as given characteristics of individuals. I mean, and that, you know, section at the end is that there is that every person within these social categories has the same experience, which is of course not the case. I think some things will be. I actually really don't have much to say, so I'm going to use up my last 4 minutes to just read the last paragraph of this conclusion, because I think it's good, better than anything I could say. Experience is not a word we can do without. Although given its usage to essentialize identity and reify the subject, it is tempting to abandon it altogether. But experience is so much the part of everyday language, so imbricated in our narratives, that it seems futile to argue for its expulsion. It serves as a way of talking about what happened, of establishing difference and similarity, of claiming knowledge that is unassailable. Given the ubiquity of the term, it seems to me more useful to work with it, to analyze its operations and to redefine its meanings. This entails focusing on processes of identity production, insisting on the discursive nature of experience and on the politics of its construction. Experience is at once always already an interpretation and something that needs to be interpreted. What counts as experience is neither self-evident nor straightforward. It is always contested and therefore political. The study of experience therefore must call into question the originary status of historical explanation. This will happen when historians take as their project not the reproduction and transmission of knowledge said to be arrived at through experience, but the analysis of the production of that knowledge itself. Such an analysis would constitute a genuinely non-foundational history, one which retains its explanatory power and its interest in change, but does not have to stand or reproduce naturalized categories. It cannot guarantee the historian's neutrality, for deciding which categories to historicize is inevitably political, necessarily tied to the historian's recognition of his or her stake in the production of knowledge. Experience is, in this approach, not the origin of our explanation, but that which we want to explain. This kind of approach does not undercut politics by denying the existence of subjects. It instead interrogates the process of their creation, and in doing so, refigures history and the role of historian and opens up new ways of thinking about change. That's it. I think this, I think really, both of these texts are kind of just about the importance of and the importance of wading through propaganda, of wading, of the need to be able to discern propaganda and established narratives that have been lifted up through multiple apparatuses of, you know, a power and of violence in order to like see things more, see experience more clearly. Which I think is something we're really struggling with right now, kind of like as a world, is it seems like all of these narratives have piled up and have gained such like real non-real status that you know, facts don't care about your feelings versus you're invalidating my experience. Like, it's, you know, these concepts are like kind of at war with each other. But anyway, that's the end of my time. This reading for now on Monotonic Radio. See you next week. Thank you.